first part should be known in this contract as the party of the first part.
The witness will comply under the, this I got a C rule.
Judge Hurd is stumped by this case. I've also misplaced my judge hammer.
The justice system works swiftly in the future now that they've abolished all lawyers.
My client will suggest that your client drives my client back to your client's flat, where your client will play some James Taylor.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 504. 504. Woo! I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. He can't hold it anymore. How you doing?
It's just, you know, 504 is an important law-related number.
Sure.
So, you know, I'm excited. It's episode 504.
Okay. I can't believe, I got to say, Andrew, this might be one of the biggest news days in the post-Trump era. You know, like,
yeah.
There is so much. We got, I mean, we got Cosby, which we've got to talk about. Major, you know, cultural story. A lot of people are very, I think, justifiably pissed at what's going on. That's a legal story. We got the Trump org being indicted. That's huge. We got Supreme Court ruining our lives more, I assume. I haven't even looked. all I see is
good
Supreme
assumption.
Court ruled, and then the rest, I don't even need to see the rest. It's already, they ruined our lives.
Yeah, everything is breaking, of course, on Thursday, July 1, as we record this. So we are going to have to wait until next week to discuss the Brnovich decision. That's a follow-up. Spoilers, though, if you want to understand it, just go back and listen to episode 471, because literally word for word, everything I predicted the Supreme Court would do in that episode. Yeah, this is...
For those of us who are proper noun challenged, what is Brnovich? I don't remember.
So Brnovich is the challenge to two different Arizona pieces of legislation restricting voting rights. And this was the one that got a brief kind of moment in the sun because Amy Coney Barrett asked a challenging question of the RNC, right? Was like, why do you guys have standing? And the RNC lawyer was because we want Democrats to lose. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there was a, you know, we titled the episode like RNC lawyer accidentally says the quiet part loud again. But spoiler, I predicted that the fact that she asked a marginally difficult question would in no way reflect upon the fact that she was going to vote like a Republican activist and a hack. And spoiler, that's exactly what happened. So we'll be breaking that down next Tuesday. There's so many other SCOTUS decisions that are on the whiteboard, right? NCAA decision regarding college athletes and monetizing, that's up there. The California donors disclosure, like it's too much. It's too much.
This is like, but what's funny though is this was what every single Thursday was for 4 years, Andrew.
Yeah,
it's weird to be back. Yeah, it's like, oh, I remember this is what it used to be. Every Thursday was like, blah, blah, blah. We're just juggling papers. Like, what do we cover? But so, you know, it's a nice reminder that we don't live in those times.
Yeah.
You know, while it's on my mind real quick, I have been seeing headlines that CNN's audience has dropped like 50%. Have you seen those?
I have not, but
there's also headlines that specifically like Jake Tapper's audience has like gone down 75%. And all I saw that, and I'm going to flag this now. I'm very worried about how much moneyed interest there will be in helping Trump come back into power in 2024. Because apparently it was really, really good for ratings, as we all knew all along. And just sending that out there. Be aware. Don't let them manipulate you into watching them 24/7 when they try to make Trump a thing again in 2024 or something. I'm just a heads up.
Yeah, that is an exceptionally good point. And, you know, and it explains the preferential treatment that Donald Trump got in sources you might not expect.
Yeah.
So, well, way to bring me down. I was going to say I'm doing fantastic. How are you doing, Thomas? But now...
Doing great. I'm celebrating my first cold that I haven't worried is COVID.
Nice.
You know?
Nice. Yeah,
it's been
a
while, and I got a cold. I'm like, I'm not worried that this is COVID. Every cold that I got, which wasn't that many, because all the masking and the hygiene, all that stuff we're doing helps a lot to reduce transmission of every virus. But I get a little, little cough, little whatever, and like, well, I'm dying.
Yep.
And now I'm like, yeah, I'm vaccinated. I'm confident in the science. I've just got a cold. You know, it's nice.
It is worth celebrating. So that's a good reason to be in good spirits. I have an in-depth explainer because everybody is getting the Bill Cosby decision from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court wrong. So we're going to go through that. But yeah, it's Bill Cosby, so it's gross. So I'm in a terrible mood about that. But I am excited to explain what is a tremendously misunderstood decision.
Wow.
So.
Well, let's get to it. Quick announcement. This crept up on us, but we are doing our Patreon monthly Q&A on the 4th of July. Because let's face it, what else are we celebrating? America? Nah. We're going to celebrate Patreon and the opening arguments Q&A at 12 Pacific, 3 Eastern. That's Sunday, the 4th of July. Patreon Q&A on YouTube. Reminder, everybody can come and hang out on YouTube, interact on the chat, all that good stuff. But the question asking takes place on Patreon, and Andrew will have already thrown up the question thread on Patreon. Get those questions in. Vote on the questions you want to hear asked. That helps me a lot to filter into which ones we can squeeze into that hour. So once again, come join us Sunday the 4th, 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. Grab a beer. Grab a 4th of July drink. Grab a firework. Except not, and join us. Down. Down. So, Andrew, I imagine I've just seen the headlines that everybody else has seen. You know, Cosby seems to have some sort of technicality, maybe, is free to go. But what is everybody getting wrong about this in the coverage?
Yeah. So here are the things, okay? The first is, this is one of these lawsuits that it's virtually impossible to separate the revulsion you feel at the outcome, right, from the legal analysis. So let's get this out of the way up front. Bill Cosby is a rapist who is getting let out of jail. And that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
And you have every right to think that that's a bad thing. And you should think that that's a bad thing. I'm going to tell you, I think the legal decision is, spoiler alert, completely incorrect.
Okay. Ooh. Okay.
So... yeah, so we're going to get to that. That being said, there is not and should not be anything you expect will happen as a result of this opinion other than a terrible bad person is going to, you know, serve only 2 years of a 10-year prison sentence. You should also not forget this is kind of being overlooked in some places that the DA who engineered this deal is Bruce Castor in Pennsylvania, and that was the gigantic buffoon who handled Donald Trump's defense in the second impeachment trial. And you might recall the lawyer who gave that like rambling, nonsensical, like second day. Right, David Schoen was the guy who was like, "Yeah, whatever." Bruce Castor was the guy who was like, "And I remember back when flags were flying, and you know Pepperidge Farm, and so that guy is a shill for Donald Trump and a longstanding politico. So there are the folks who were saying kind of feels like a dirtbag helped out Bill Cosby. That's true. Not relevant at all to the legal analysis other than as we're going to talk about. So there are, as one might say, a lot of low cards in this poker hand. There will not. This was an opinion by the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. The state may, or the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, may appeal to the Supreme Court for reasons that I'm about to explain. The Supreme Court, I feel very confident in saying, will not grant cert, and you would not want them to for the reasons that I will explain. This opinion drew one dissent, but even that dissent revealed that he would have reversed Cosby's conviction on a different ground, right?
Huh.
So, yeah. So there is widespread concurrence at the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that the trial court verdict convicting Bill Cosby should not stand. I don't understand this. And I'm going to hopefully lead everybody to a position of not understanding it. There is one point that I want to bring
here. By the time you're done here, you too will not understand what happened.
You too. Yeah. There is one part that I will bracket that has to do with the fact that I am a civil litigator, not a prosecutor, not a public defender, not a criminal defense attorney. I have talked to a number of folks, a couple of prosecutors, three prosecutors, two public defenders, one criminal defense attorney, and they all have confirmed my judgment, but it's possible, like in a greater sample size, that I'm wrong. So I will bracket that part, but nevertheless, here we go.
So this is really frustrating because I had assumed this would be, well, he got out, but you know, it's a somebody messed something up legally, and it's the kind of principle that we wouldn't want actual innocent people being put away for the same thing. Are you saying it's not even that?
There is a real principle at stake here, but I believe it is being incorrectly applied in this case. Hmm. And I think as a result of this decision, it is unlikely to be beneficially applied in future cases. But striking down that principle would be even worse. So we'll get to that.
Okay.
I want to give a small content warning here for about the next minute to two, because it is important to explain in the legal posture, in the broadest possible terms, the methodology of the underlying crime, right? What Bill Cosby did repeatedly to at least 19 different women, as far as we can tell. So we're not going to get into huge, but we are going to talk about that for a minute or two. And if that's sensitive, then you should fast forward ahead about 2 minutes. So Bill Cosby is alleged and has been convicted of a jury of finding an excuse to give women pills, in particular Quaaludes, call them something else, like Benadryl, and then provide them with alcohol that has the effect of making the woman unconscious. And then he would engage in sexual conduct, often rape, when he was 100% sober and they were literally unconscious. In January of 2004, that's what he did to a woman named Andrea Constant. And I should say, she has sued him civilly. That's a matter of public record. So that's why I'm comfortable using the survivor's name here. Okay. So Ms. Constant did not report that drugging and improper sexual conduct to the police until a year later, January of 2005, which, by the way, totally normal. Okay. That is not anything from which I think anybody who works with survivors of sexual assault would find surprising, but it did play a role in what happened next. Okay. That's it. If you're coming back from having skipped ahead, we're now done with sort of talking about the details. The DA at the time was Bruce Castor, and he said in light of the circumstances, there were three things, I'm just going to quote from the opinion, that led him to decide not to prosecute Bill Cosby in 2005. So he says, quote, "In evaluating the likelihood of a successful prosecution, the district attorney," that's Castor, "foresaw difficulties with Constance's credibility as a witness based in part upon her decision not to file a complaint promptly. She waited a year. He thought that would make her a challenging witness on the stand. He has his right to draw that conclusion as a prosecutor. It doesn't really seem consistent with what I've read and the folks that I've talked to." But okay, so that was
sort of, and this is in 2005 or six by this time?
Right.
So yeah, I would hope now that, you know, maybe that isn't the attitude among prosecutors, possibly.
Again, from the prosecutors that I've spoken to, it that does not seem to be a common attitude. It seems to be much more, yeah, we understand that survivors of sexual assault may take time in reporting that. Okay. So DA Castor further determined that a prosecution would be frustrated because there was no corroborating forensic evidence, right? That's always a problem. And because testimony from other potential claimants against Cosby likely was inadmissible under governing laws of evidence. We're going to talk about that. The collective weight of these three considerations led Castor to conclude that unless Cosby confessed, quote, "there was insufficient credible and admissible evidence upon which any charge against Mr. Cosby related to the Constant incident would be proven beyond a reasonable doubt." So if we stop there, that's prosecutorial discretion, mm-hmm. right? You might agree or disagree with it. I would disagree with it, but they're allowed to do that.
Right.
Then there is a bunch of what I would describe as self-serving testimony from Castor. I'm going to explain it. I'm going to say that there is, I don't discount it, but you need to remember this is an elected position. He is an elected Republican politician. And so he's got to explain, like, why is he giving a pass on terrible charges, you know, to a prominent celebrity. So Castor has then said he decided that Constant's best option would be to sue Cosby civilly for monetary damages. And, quote, to aid Constant in that pursuit, as the sovereign, as the district attorney, he decided that his office would not prosecute Cosby, believing that that decision ultimately would set off the chain of events that he thought would gain some justice for Andrea Constant. By removing the threat of criminal prosecution, Cosby would no longer be able in a civil lawsuit to invoke his Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. Otherwise, if you've got a pending prosecution, you can just take the Fifth in a civil lawsuit and say, yeah, no, I'm not going to testify here on the grounds that it might tend to incriminate me. This, by the way, is why, you know, things like the OJ civil suit followed after the criminal trial, right? Like, you get the criminal suit adjudicated first, and then you can't take five in the civil lawsuit. So the idea was, Castor is saying, look, I'm not going to prosecute you. I'm going to say that publicly, but I'm really doing you a favor, because if I were to prosecute Cosby, Ms. Constant, we would likely lose and you would get nothing. And now, at least this way, I can step aside and you can sue him civilly and, you know, maybe get some measure out of that.
That doesn't make sense to me because you just brought up OJ.
It makes absolutely no sense, right? Because you're not doing her a favor by not prosecuting, right? Like, the not prosecuting is the same as prosecuting and losing in terms of it's a different standard of evidence. And the OJ case, it would have been 10 years earlier at this point, and would have been a perfect roadmap, right? Would have said, hey, we're going to try. And if we come up
the
short,
person
you know,
is
you
obviously
still have,
guilty, just like in the other case.
And then you have a roadmap of how to recover civilly. So I will also say that the reason I find this to be self-serving is that if you are a district attorney and you want to eliminate the possibility that a potential criminal defendant is going to invoke the Fifth Amendment, there are at least three things you could prosecute, right? So there are at least four things you could do, right? Number one, you could prosecute. That's the OJ plan. Number two, you could enter into a plea agreement or a deferred prosecutorial agreement with Cosby. There is no evidence that they ever tried to do that, right? That they said, hey, plead out to this, you know, lesser crime, or plead out to no crime whatsoever in connection with these certain conditions, and then double jeopardy would attach. That would make that go away, and they would be immune from being able to assert the Fifth Amendment in the civil context. That didn't happen. You could have a written non-prosecutorial agreement that would either have conditions or not. Again, that didn't happen. And finally, you could, at minimum, grant Cosby transactional immunity for in connection with the Constant incident, which again, that's how this is described in the court opinion. So I'm just going to use the court's language, and I apologize if it comes off as insensitive. You could grant transactional immunity. That's a thing where you have to go to the court and you have to file it, and you got to say, like, we think because of, you know, pending civil proceedings that this witness should be given transactional immunity, should not be prosecuted for anything in connection with this particular incident. That didn't happen, right? Nobody ever went to the court. Castor never went to the court to say you should do any one of these three things. I need to point out, if he had done any of those three things, then this decision would be binding for all time. It would have eliminated Cosby's ability to plead the Fifth in a civil deposition for monetary damages, would have made things perfectly clear. Castor didn't do any of that. What he did was he issued a press release. Okay. This is on page 12 of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court opinion. And here's what it said. As such, District Attorney Castor declines to authorize the filing of criminal charges in connection with this matter. Because a civil action with a much lower standard of proof is possible, the District Attorney renders no opinion concerning the credibility of any party involved so as not to contribute to the publicity and taint prospective jurors. The District Attorney does not intend to expound publicly on the details of his decision for fear that his opinions and analysis might be given undue weight by jurors in any contemplated civil action.
That just seems really weird to me.
Yeah, it seemed really, really weird to me, too. This was the part at which I called up a bunch of my prosecutor friends, and I said, hey, do you ever do that? And two-way person, they said, no, right? If you've decided not to prosecute, if you've exercised prosecutorial discretion, you would inform the victim and you would inform the potential defendant. And okay, maybe, you know, if there's a huge amount of press about it, you might, you know, give a press release explaining your decision. But this is not how you memorialize binding decision.
Yeah, and the way it was worded sounded like some legal principle of like, well, if there is a civil case to be made, then that's why, you know, it frames it like that. Like if there's a civil case with a lower burden, so therefore we're not going to pursue charges, which is like, okay, but isn't that always the case? I mean, you just talked about OJ. I mean, what if somebody kills somebody and you're like, well, we could charge them with murder, but there's a civil case to be made that's a lower standard of evidence, so we're not going to charge him with murder.
Well, and believe me, I don't want to rush to Castor's defense here, but being devil's advocate here, I think what he would say is, right, but remember that I've concluded, right, I'm exercising my prosecutorial discretion because I've concluded we're not likely to win in the criminal case. But I don't want to go into great detail about that because I don't want my statements here to potentially taint the jury pool that might look at a subsequent civil action with a lower standard of proof and be skeptical of that as well.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. So that's the key. So he's saying because it's not just because there's a civil action available, which is kind of what the statement sounded like, but it's because of that plus not thinking you're going to get the actual criminal conviction. So therefore, okay, I guess that makes a little more sense. So what's the part that all your friends are saying they would never do? Just release this.
All my friends are saying that if you intend to bind yourself and your office, which is what Castor is claiming and what is the basis for this Pennsylvania Supreme Court opinion, to never prosecute Cosby, you wouldn't do it this way. You would do one of the three things that I've just described, right? You would have a plea agreement or deferred prosecution. You would have a non-prosecutorial agreement. Yeah. Or at minimum, you would go to the court and give him transactional immunity. That would establish for all time, I'm not prosecuting this guy. Therefore, he can't claim Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination if you want to sue him, right?
Interesting. And that's the only reason you would want to do that, right? Because otherwise— Correct. What's in it for them to be like, we're never going to prosecute you? I would think apart from the whole pleading the fifth thing, setting that aside, wouldn't you want to be like, well, you know, we're not getting you now, Mr. Rapist, but like, I guess we'll allow that maybe some other evidence could come to light someday that would allow us to pursue this.
That's exactly right. Right. Remember, look, we've talked about the contours of prosecutorial discretion in the Michael Flynn case, for example, right? So in general, the rule is, and this is what we're, and again, Pennsylvania is slightly different than federal law, but by and large, like the principles here are incredibly similar. And that is the prosecution has wide range, a DA, the prosecutor has wide ranging discretion to decide whether or not to bring a case. And they can change their mind. Now, like Federal Rule 45, could you envision a situation where it becomes abusive? Where I bring the case and then I drop it on the eve of trial and then I bring it again. Yeah, you could, right? And so we have some protections for you against that. But by and large, prosecutorial discretion means just that. You can't get mandamus. It's discretion. And you can change your mind if new evidence comes to light. So if I'm Constance's lawyer, I am 100% not satisfied with this as a press release because, you know, yeah, you're saying, okay, not going to prosecute him. Feel free. Go ahead. Call him in the civil trial and he won't be able to take five. But I'm sitting there going, Cosby's lawyers are going to say this reflects District Attorney Bruce Castor's opinion at this point in time, but he could always change his mind. But somehow that's not what happened. And I have gone back and I have dug into the underlying trial records a little bit. I mean, this case broke yesterday. I have read several hundred pages on it already. There are thousands of pages in the public domain. And what I want to tell you is that there is, I believe, some mischaracterization about exactly how willing Bill Cosby was to testify in those civil depositions. So first is, he was deposed on four separate occasions in the civil lawsuit. I will tell you, as somebody who deposes witnesses all the time, that is not a usual course of action. Usually you get one bite at the apple. You bring in your witness, you depose that person, and then you're done. When you have multiple depositions, it is because they have refused to answer questions and you have to go back to the judge and order them to sit again and answer them this time, or new evidence comes out or something was concealed or whatever. So Cosby was deposed on four separate occasions. But here's what we do know. In none of those did he assert his Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. He then, in those depositions, ultimately admitted that he had done what he was alleged to have done to Andrea Constant to other women. That lawsuit then, presumably once that admission came out, led to a settlement for $3.38 million. And the settlement was sealed. It was sealed for a decade. But then there was a request by a media outlet to unseal the records, and a judge opened them up in 2015. And that, by the way, is when the Cosby stories broke. That's a year before you and I started OA. But like, right, that's when that's when everything hit all the news about
who Hannibal Bill Cosby Burris, was. Doing his little stand-up routine. Lit off that whole thing somehow.
So by 2015, now this is national news, and Castor is no longer DA. Instead, his former assistant, Risa Furman, is now the district attorney, and she decides to reopen the investigation. And when she does, Castor writes a letter, and the letter says, "You were there when we decided that we would never prosecute Bill Cosby." And Furman wrote back and said, "What the hell are you talking about?" and said it in lawyer speak, which was, "I do not recall any such agreement, but if you have a signed agreement not to prosecute Bill Cosby, please forward it to me." And what Castor said was, "Well, here's the press release." And Furman was like, "Uh-huh, and he was like, no, that not and, like, that's what we've got. And Furman was like, "Okay, but this is your prosecutorial discretion, but now I'm the prosecutor and I'm exercising my prosecutorial discretion." So she reopened the investigation in 2015. In January of 2016, Cosby was indicted under 18 Pennsylvania Criminal Statute Section 3125 for three counts of aggravated indecent assault. That is a second degree felony. And those three counts are as follows: 3125A, a person who engages in penetration of the genitals or anus with a part of the person's body commits aggravated indecent assault if, and then here are the three conditions. Number one, the person does so without the complainant's consent. Number four, the complainant is unconscious, or the person knows that the complainant is unaware that the penetration is occurring. Or number five, the person has substantially impaired the complainant's power to apprise or control his or her conduct by administering or employing, without the knowledge of the complainant, drugs, intoxicants, for other means of the purpose of preventing resistance. Okay, so we talked about Cosby's MO. Very clearly fits.
Yeah, fits that.
Seems to be slam dunk. Those charges are filed in January 2016. Bill Cosby immediately files a habeas petition and says, "Wait, Castor promised us he would never, ever sue us." And so the court then held a hearing and evaluated that habeas petition. And the trial court said, quote, "The only conclusion that was apparent from the record was that no agreement or promise not to prosecute ever existed, only the exercise of prosecutorial discretion." End of quote. Seems pretty straightforward.
Case closed.
Right? Case closed, right? So that case went to trial May of 2016. There was a ton of crazy procedural stuff I am not going to get into, with the exception of this, which is Rule 404. And we've actually talked about this before. This is the carjacker Willie test, right? Wow. Like I'm going to allow that because it characterizes the defendant as a carjacker, right? And what it means is you cannot generally introduce prior evidence of what we call bad acts that demonstrate a person's character for purposes of showing that they were likely to have acted in connection with that character, right? So you have been twice convicted of a crime of violence. You don't get to say, "I want to introduce this record that this person is likely to commit violence," to then show that they probably, you know, committed the assault for which they are currently charged with. Not because it is not relevant. It's obviously highly relevant, right? If you're Carjacker Willie, the fact that you're a carjacker is probably highly likely to determine whether you've jacked this particular car, but it is that the prejudicial value greatly exceeds, right? Like it's but the second. Yeah.
Haven't you said that you could establish an MO or like a precise pattern of how you do these things?
That is exactly right. And it is sometimes called a signature or MO. And it is, I'm going to read you Pennsylvania's rule 404, because we've talked about the federal rule, but this is in pari materia with the federal rules. Prohibited uses. So this is 404B. Evidence of a crime, wrong, or other act is not admissible to prove a person's character in order to show that on a particular occasion, the person acted in accordance with the character. Okay, that's the general rule. But number two, subsection two, this evidence may be admissible for another purpose, such as proving motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, plan, knowledge, identity, absence of mistake, or lack of accident. In a criminal case, this evidence is admissible only if the probative value of the evidence outweighs its potential for unfair prejudice. Right. So when you have a particular signature, you can then introduce that precise method as a way of showing intent, preparation, plan, lack of accident. And that's exactly what the prosecutor sought to do in the Cosby case. 19 women came forward, and all of them had stories to varying degrees that were substantially similar to Constance's stories, right? That is, Cosby would get them alone, give them alcohol plus pills, would find some excuse to give them pills, would tell them the pills were something else. The pills turned out to be Quaaludes. And then while they were unconscious, you know, would proceed. And then the trial court judge said, you know what? That seems like evidence of a signature, right? That seems like evidence of a plan and lack of mistake. So I am going to allow to the prosecutors, I'm going to allow you to put one of these women on the stand. Why not all 19? Because that's the prejudicial part, right? Like you could imagine a parade of all of these prior witnesses. It's no longer establishing the pattern. It is now just establishing this is a bad guy. And again, let's be very, very clear. Bill Cosby is a very, very bad guy. At that first trial, you might be surprised. I was surprised. I certainly didn't remember this from the time. June 17th, 2017, after 7 days of jury deliberations, they got an Allen charge. That was the, come on, guys, figure this out. And the jury came back and said, we're hopelessly deadlocked. That was a mistrial. Unlike a lot of other criminal cases, the DA in this case was like, okay, fine, you mistrial. We're going to bring the same case again. And you're allowed to do that, right? Like a mistrial does not, double jeopardy does not attach to a mistrial. The likelihood of subsequent convictions go down. We've talked about this in a lot of our blood-awful movies. So a mistrial is often considered a victory for the defendant. And as a practical matter, it certainly is associated with a range of better outcomes. But here the DA's office was like, yeah, no, we're going ahead. And so they retried the case. And in the second trial, they requested to have more prior bad act testimony. And in the second case, the judge permitted 5 women to testify. This is on pages 31 to 34 of the opinion. Again, you can go, if you have the stomach for it, you can go read their stories. I don't think that it's important for us to do that. At that second trial, that's when Cosby was convicted. And that led to this appeal. And here were the two issues that Cosby raised on appeal. The first was all the stuff that we just talked about illegal propensity evidence? And then the second had to do with the press release. And it's such a bad argument. I'm going to read how it was presented to the court. Right? So this is how Bill Cosby's lawyers presented it to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. They said, quote, where District Attorney Castor agreed that Cosby would not be prosecuted in order to force Cosby's testimony at a deposition in a civil action, the district attorney issued a formal public statement reflecting that agreement, and Cosby reasonably relied upon those oral and written statements by providing deposition testimony in the civil action, thus forfeiting his constitutional right against self-incrimination. Did the panel, that's the intermediate appellate court that upheld the trial court's decision, err in affirming the trial court's decision to allow not only the prosecution of Cosby, but the admission of his civil deposition testimony? And that convoluted, crazy argument about reliance is what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court reversed on. They said that under the facts here, Cosby reasonably relied on the press release from Castor in deciding to testify in the civil case. So therefore, that was binding, and now he's entitled to some relief. I will tell you this case, we're going to put a pin in that because I want to talk about how they get to the relief in a minute, which is another, in my view, kind of clear error. But to me, this is just dead wrong. And it's not dead wrong for a lot of the reasons you're seeing in the public, but it's dead wrong because this is a very clear fact-based question, and an appellate court should not be reviewing questions of fact for anything other than clear error, right? This Pennsylvania decision says this is a question of law. It is not. Here is the fact question. The fact question is, was the press release by Castor a binding non-prosecution agreement, or was it not? Or was it an exercise of prosecutorial discretion?
And it sounds like they turned that question into, well, did Cosby rely on it or not?
That is exactly right. And the point is that for reliance to generate a legally protected interest, that reliance must be reasonable. And I would argue, and again, I've gone to my prosecution, you know, my prosecutor friends, my criminal defense attorney friends, I could be persuaded otherwise. If you flood our email box and say, no, this happens all the time where, you know, we just say we're not going to prosecute you. And then people go on and testify in civil suits and waive their Fifth Amendment privilege. Okay, I'm open to that. I will tell you, that does not seem to be my experience from a lawyer who reads a lot of criminal cases. It does not seem to be the experience of the criminal lawyers that I've talked to, but I could be wrong on that. I want to flag that. Assuming that I'm not wrong on that, this opinion is bonkers. And I can prove that. And part of the way in which I can prove that is that the only law cited for the proposition in this entire opinion shows up on page 60, footnote 23. And by their own merits, all of these cases are about plea agreements. Not a single one of them is about ex parte statements or press releases or whatever, right? They're all about when there is a plea deal. Hey, everybody, this is an ad for Moinkbox. You know my pitch. It is literally the tastiest bacon I have ever had. I'm going to tell you this until each and every one of our subscribers that, you know, eats meat has signed up for Moinkbox. Seriously, you should. It's amazing. It's delicious. Moink delivers grass-fed and grass-finished beef and lamb, pastured pork and chicken, and wild-caught Alaskan salmon direct to your door. That helps family farms become financially independent outside of big agriculture. Moinkbox animals are raised outdoors. Their fish swim wild in the ocean. Moink meat is free of antibiotics, hormones, sugar, all that other junk that you find prepackaged in the meat aisle. And of course, the real pitch, the one I keep telling you about. You sign up at moinkbox.com/OA. You get a year of bacon for free. And then you can pick what meats you want delivered with your first box. You can change that up each month. You can cancel anytime. And they're so happy with my promo, they no longer make me read the copy of Oink Oink, I'm so happy I just got boinked. They do still have the bit in here about Shark Tank. Look, I don't know what Shark Tank is, but Moink was founded by an 8th-generation farmer who was featured on Shark Tank, and host Kevin O'Leary said it was the best bacon he's ever tasted. I don't know who that is, but they're 100% right. The bacon is amazing. Jamie Simonoff, creator of the Ring video doorbell, invested in Moink. Anyway, here's what I want you to do. Head on over, moinkbox.com/OA. Go there right now. Listeners, you will get free bacon for a year, and the bacon is amazing. That's 1 year of the best bacon you will ever taste, but limited time offer, moinkbox.com/OA. That's moinkbox.com/OA. Get it. The bacon's amazing. The meat's really good. You'll love it. So I totally agree, right? Like, if there was a plea deal, right? If Cosby got something in exchange, right? And gave up something in exchange for not being prosecuted, then yeah, you can't. There's no takesies backsies on that. Prosecutorial discretion is the thing in which there is takesies backsies. And here's how the court itself puts it. Quote, numerous state and federal courts have found that a defendant's detrimental reliance upon the government's assurances during the plea bargaining phase both implicates his due process rights and entitles him to enforcement of even unconsummated agreements. The cases are legion. End of quote. That's all true. Absolutely. The state cannot enter into a plea bargaining agreement, lead you to believe that they're going to, you know, give you a reduced sentence or deferred prosecution or non-prosecution, and then, you know, Lucy with the football, pull it away at the 11th hour and be like, yeah, we've decided not to. And by the way, like, all of the stuff you've said to us in the interim, we're now going to use against you, right? Like, yeah, totally. That would be insane. You can't do that. That never, ever happened here. And you know how I know that never, ever happened here?
How do you know that never, ever happened here?
That argument was made during Bill Cosby's 2016 habeas corpus petition to the trial court, and the trial court decided that that did not happen here. It looked at the totality of the circumstances, the weight of the evidence, the press release, all of the surrounding details, and it said no binding agreement existed. So on appeal, that is not a question of law. That's a question of fact. Was there a binding agreement not to prosecute? The trial court said, no, there wasn't. And who the hell is an appellate court, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, to say, no, we think you probably got those facts wrong.
And that is so weird.
It is crazy. And one justice, Justice Saylor, dissented and said, yeah, this seems completely nuts. Why am I the only sane one here? Saylor's dissent says, I respectfully disagree with the majority's determination that the press release issued by former DA Bruce Castor contained an unconditional promise that the Commonwealth would not prosecute appellant in perpetuity. Rather, I read the operative language, and I read this to you earlier, District Attorney Castor declines to authorize the filing of criminal charges in connection with this matter, as a conventional public announcement of a present exercise of prosecutorial discretion by the temporary occupant of the elected office of district attorney that would be in no way binding upon his own future decision-making processes, let alone those of his
somebody
successor.
Somebody else's,
yeah.
Wow. That seems very clear.
It seems 100% clear to me. Again, as I flagged for you at the outset, Saylor noted that he would probably reverse on the other issue. Right. He says, I note, however, that I have substantial reservations about the trial court's decision to permit the Commonwealth to introduce testimony from other victims of sexual assaults by appellant, which allegedly occurred between 15 and 22 years in the past. Since under the majority's approach, that issue is moot, I merely take the opportunity to note in my present tentative inclination would be to award a new trial grounded upon appellant's challenge to such evidence as being unduly prejudicial. So even Saylor thinks the prosecution was wrong, you know, but for a different reason. But that dissent raises the question I told you to put a pin in, which is, okay, let's assume that the press release is binding. Why should the relief be what this court awarded, which was the conviction is vacated, go free Bill Cosby? And why not just remand it back down to the trial court, have another trial, and suppress the evidence that was obtained in connection with the detrimental reliance, right?
Sounds reasonable to me.
That once you've said, okay, you justifiably relied on a press release, which again, I think is wrong, but assume that that's correct. Then the question is, what's the relief to which you were entitled? Should it be narrow or should it be broad? And here, once again, Pennsylvania Supreme Court is rewriting its own rules. How do I know that? Because of a 1995 case called Commonwealth versus Stiptic. Here's what happened in that case. Pittsburgh police promised George and Heidi Stiptic that if they answered questions about the source of drugs found in their home, right? Hey, who was the dealer? No charges would be filed against them. But shocker, police lie. Don't take legal advice from a podcast, but yeah, if the police say we can get you a great deal, you say, I want to talk to my lawyer. Anyway, so the police said, yeah. You just tell us where you got the drugs. We will definitely not prosecute you for possession of drugs. The Stiptics fulfilled their part of the agreement, and then prosecutors charged them anyway. The trial court granted the motion to dismiss and said, yeah, come on. Like, are you kidding me? The cops came, said, we won't prosecute you if you give up who the dealer was. They gave up who the dealer was, and then you prosecuted them anyway. You're kidding me, right?
Yeah.
Pennsylvania Supreme Court overturned that trial court decision and said, look, the Pittsburgh Police Department had no authority to bind the district attorney's office to a non-prosecution agreement.
But weird that they wouldn't say these people relied on that promise in making their decision.
And so I love the way you're building this lawyer mind. That is exactly then the question the Supreme Court had to address. And here's what they said. okay, but you're saying they probably relied on the fact that the police said, hey, we're not going to prosecute you. Quote, the proper response to this concern, that is the reliance concern, is not to bar prosecution. Rather, it is to suppress at the appropriate juncture any detrimental evidence procured through the inaccurate representation that he would not be prosecuted. And then cites to the various authorities 1977 case that says, yeah, that's how we do it. This places the Stipetics in the same position as if the unauthorized promise to prosecute had never been made by the police. Citation to another case. So, yeah, seems like you read Stipetic and you're like, okay, if you accidentally relied on a promise that turned out to be invalid, then what we want to do is put you in the position as if that promise had never been made. So we will suppress the evidence obtained from your deposition, but that's now then up to the prosecutors to then go forward with whatever they have, right? And the prosecutors might say, without the depo, we can't go forward, but who knows? Let's leave it up to the right? That's the whole prosecutorial discretion part. I'm going to read you what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said in distinguishing the Stipetic decision, which is, again, 100% on point. So, Morgan, while you're listening, don't argue this way. This is the worst effort to distinguish a case that I've ever heard. Here's what they say. They give three reasons. They say this remedy is insufficient. This remedy of new trial suppress the evidence is insufficient here. First, as noted, the remedy statement was dicta in Stipetic and is not the law in Pennsylvania. Okay, right. So that's always the way, unless you have a good basis to explain why dicta shouldn't be informative in this case, right? Saying it's not the holding is just saying you should take this persuasively rather than binding. So that's not a great argument. It's good as a threshold, but just saying, well, though, you know, that was technically dicta because that's not the result that they ordered in that case, not a great argument. Second, the circumstances that led to that suggestion of that remedy are markedly different than the present case. In Stipetic, the agreement was formulated with arresting officers who lacked the authority to make the promise not to prosecute. Here, the non-prosecution decision was made by the elected DA of Montgomery County, whose public announcement of that decision was fully within his authority and was objectively worthy of reasonable reliance. Okay. This is what we call, in the legal world, the proverbial distinction without a difference, right? Because all they're saying is, we think it was reasonable for Cosby to rely on the statements by Castor. But that has nothing to do with the relief that you order, right? Like, we have already assumed for purposes of this section, okay, your reliance was reasonable. Now, what do you get in exchange for your reliance? And the answer is, you should be put in the position that you would have been in had you not relied. So that argument is nothing. That argument goes nowhere. We've already said, yeah, you're valid to rely on it. So the last argument they make is, as far as I can tell, an argument that is an own goal, right? Finally, a one-size-fits-all remedy does not comport with the individualized due process inquiry that must be undertaken. In some instances, suppression of evidence may be an adequate remedy. In others, only specific enforcement will suffice. Here, the full enforcement of the decision not to prosecute, only the full enforcement of the decision not to prosecute can satisfy the fundamental demands of due process. Anything less would permit the Commonwealth to extract incriminating evidence from a defendant who relies upon the elected prosecutor's words, actions, and intent, and then use that evidence against the defendant with impunity.
Oh, this is terrible.
No, like the remedy, if that's what they do, if they illegally obtain evidence, the remedy is to suppress that evidence. It's just crazy. It is bonkers, and nobody is explaining that it's bonkers for rewriting the facts.
Yeah, it's changed. So it's blended a couple things, it sounds like. It's like, okay, maybe there's a question of whether or not he relied on it, whether or not that's reasonable. And as you say, the remedy would be, okay, well, maybe if he relied on it and it's reasonable that he relied on it, then do a take-backsy on whatever testimony or whatever deposition resulted as of that. But then they're also, it sounds like they're also combining that with, and also because he relied on it, therefore we have to treat this as an actual promise not to prosecute. And the only remedy is for him to never have been prosecuted. Do I have that right?
That is exactly, you understand perfectly.
Well, that's stupid. This is bad. This is a bad law thingy. I move for a bad court thingy.
It is absolutely a bad law thingy. And again, as I flagged from the outset, and now we can kind of, you know, wrap it all back up. You could take this to the Supreme Court, but dear God, you would not want to, right?
Like, why is that?
Because I do not want the conservative monsters at this Supreme Court to rewrite the idea of how far your Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination goes. That would be an awful, awful result. And the Fifth Amendment is what everyday criminal defendants need in order to protect themselves from abuse at the hands of the police, right? So, you know, we would wind up with, you know, more of the situation like what we have with the stipe ticks.
So is the Supreme Court the next step here? There's no
This is the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. So that they can say that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court misinterpreted the scope and protections of the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. That would be the basis for a cert petition.
Right, but I'm just asking, so remind me the procedural stuff here. There's no circuit appeal because it's criminal? Is that why?
Because we have omitted the fact that the Intermediate Pennsylvania Appellate Court affirmed the trial court decision. And affirmed it on the grounds that we described in going through the case. Namely, yeah, this is a factual determination. This was prosecutorial discretion, not a non-prosecution agreement. Therefore, there was no reasonable reliance interest. Therefore, conviction stands. So this is the Pennsylvania Supreme Court overturning that intermediate appellate court decision. And there's no higher place you can go in Pennsylvania. You can make a collateral appeal up to... Sorry, I should scratch that. It is not a collateral appeal. It's an appeal on the merits, but you can petition for cert to the Supreme Court to say, hey, this part where the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was purporting to analyze the Fifth Amendment, they got that wrong. The Supreme Court is the highest adjudicator of constitutional rights, so we want you to weigh in on that.
I know, this is probably a stupid question, but can you tell me why there is no circuit court thing? It goes straight from Pennsylvania Supreme Court to Supreme Court. Is that just because of the nature of the law involved here?
Yes, because when it comes to state law, state Supreme Courts, states are sovereign, right? Uh-huh. So if this were, and on the other issue, if this had come out, for example, on the prior bad act testimony, and it was entirely on the interpretation of Pennsylvania Rule 404, then there would be no recourse anywhere. Right? It would stop at the Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
Okay.
But there is an exception when state Supreme Courts issue an opinion that depends upon their analysis of federal law or federal constitutional provisions that you can then go to the U.S. Supreme Court and say, hey, Pennsylvania is trying to interpret the Fifth Amendment and they suck at it. Come in and tell them that they're wrong.
So I had absorbed that in criminal stuff, there you kind of skip past the circuit, but it's not exactly true. It's just because of the way the laws are state versus kind of federal.
Correct.
Stuff.
And,
okay.
And keep in mind that, you know, Bill Cosby has already had, right, two appeals as of right, right? He went to the Pennsylvania Intermediate Appellate Court and then up to the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court, right? So it is not as though that there has not been adequate process afforded to this particular criminal defendant.
Well, my view on the whole Supreme Court thing, Andrew, is they're going to ruin everything anyway. So if they're going to ruin everything anyway, might as well put Cosby back in prison while you're doing it. Well, what do you think it'll be like? Well, we didn't do this bullet dodged forever with the Supreme Court on the Fifth Amendment stuff. I don't know.
It's hard to argue against that particular view of the Supreme Court.
Well, that's awful, Andrew. I can't believe that happened. I'm in disbelief. And do you know of any other... You know, I mean, my feeling on Cosby, because I don't pay that much attention to it because it's so unpleasant, but my feeling was there's so many victims that, like Weinstein, there'd be some other charges or state or victims or something. Is there anything else that people can get him on?
If what you want here is to look for a silver lining, it would be an analogy to the original Castor press release, right? Which is to say this would permit And I believe that some attorneys for some of the other survivors of Cosby's assaults are planning to come forward. And I know there's at least one pending action that was stayed, right? That was a civil action that was stayed pending the result from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And again, this now clarifies in connection with that Cosby will not be able to take the Fifth Amendment.
Yeah, but that's still all civil stuff. So he's not going to prison.
There will not be continued criminal prosecutions in many of these cases. You know, the statute of limitations has expired, and certainly, like, you know, a lot of these women are from the time period 1982 to 1989. And again, right, that does not change the analysis. It certainly changes, you know, the willingness of a prosecutor to prosecute. Yeah.
Well, take him for all he's worth then, at least. Yep. Hopefully all his money will go to the victims in some form. That's all I'm rooting for now.
Absolutely. And I want to relate one thing. A dear friend of mine, Amanda, hi Amanda, is friends with the foreperson of the jury that convicted Cosby the first time around, and passed on to me that person's statement, which was, and again, it sort of stands in contrast as Cosby and, you know, Felicia Rashad took like a victory lap, and it just nonsense, right? We've walked through. This in no way invalidates the underlying factual determinations that were made at that trial. It is absolutely not a vindication. And so the four person said in a public statement, and I suppose I could reveal this person's name, but I'm going to keep them confidential. Pennsylvania Supreme Court has overturned Mr. Cosby's conviction. While he has not been found innocent, the presumption of innocence returns. This decision by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is based upon a legal technicality of due process rights agreed upon, unfortunately, by the former Montgomery County DA. The jurors that found Mr. Cosby guilty did so based upon the facts presented during the trial that included the charges of indecent sexual assault against Andrea Constant. We came to the unanimous decision based upon thoughtful and meticulous consideration of the information and evidence provided to us, and I, as the foreperson of the jury that convicted Mr. Cosby, stand firmly by our decision of Mr. Cosby's guilt. The time we spent in sequestration was not in vain. The jurors did our job and came to the right and just decision. Today, a rapist has been set free.
Wow, what a foreperson.
I agree. So there we go. Hopefully you understand more, even if...
I think you should be more mad than maybe you were. That is worse than I expected.
I agree. Yeah.
So we are way over time because this is an outrageous story. But Andrew, we got to at least touch on the Trump org and the indictments. I guess do your best lightning round.
Yeah. So we actually talked about this on yesterday's cleanup on aisle 45 with beloved ACE associate Morgan Stringer sitting in for Allison Gill. So if you haven't heard that one, go listen to cleanup 24. Essentially, here's the situation. Today, the Manhattan DA's office brought an indictment against the Trump Org as a company, which you can do for criminal fraud. And
Romney reasons.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Corporations are people, my friend. Morgan said that on the show. It was great. And also against Alan Weisselberg, that is the chief financial officer for the Trump Org, the person who knows where the financial bodies are buried. It is very, very clear to me that this first round of charges are designed to get Weisselberg to flip. We have seen reports that Weisselberg was starting to cooperate and that the New York District Attorney's Office got frustrated with his lack of cooperation. You cannot make a criminal case against Donald Trump or any of the higher up execs, Don Trump Jr., at the Trump Org without Weisselberg's cooperation. So this is a necessary first step in order to produce a plea agreement and cooperation from Weisselberg to flip on Trump. Is it going to work? I don't know. But I do know that, like, that was always the linchpin to this case from the beginning. And that's the way to understand and read these indictments. So, you know, Trump is going to take a victory lap and say, well, see, they didn't indict me. Well, of course they didn't. You're right. Like, you can't indict Trump. You don't have a reasonable likelihood of success until you can get the person who signed all the checks to be able to say, yes, my boss, Donald Trump, told me to sign X particular check. And the key to that person, Alan Weisselberg.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. And just time for a quick correction. We got a few emails about this. If it was one, I would have just assumed that someone misheard me. But since it was a couple, I'm going to go ahead and assume that I made a mistake in how I said something here. But regarding the school that's his name I can't pronounce.
Stuyvesant.
Stuyvesant. Yeah, there you go. So you were talking about how there are so few black students at Stuyvesant, right? And then you said something like, and these schools are, schools like this are essentially a pipeline to the Ivy League, to Harvard and Yale kind of thing. And then I jumped in with, and at those places, legacy admissions are vastly outnumber the number of black students. And I was just trying to make the point that, like, we have there's already a pipeline problem in the Stuyvesant type high school. And also it's, here's the signs of how bad it is at the Ivy League. But I think a lot of people interpreted me to be saying that at Stuyvesant, that was true. Like there's legacy admissions at that school. Just want to emphasize that's not what I meant, mainly because I've never heard of that school and know nothing about it. So I definitely wasn't, this isn't like a me trying to recreate what I said, because I don't even know what that school is, so I wouldn't have said that. What I was referring to, and I just want to throw this in here, now that I've grabbed some numbers for you, I was talking about, you know, Harvard specifically, when people complain about affirmative action, and conservatives really, and actually a lot of mainstream, just everybody, has this idea that, like, you know, if you're a black student, you just can walk right into Harvard because of affirmative action, right? You just walk right in, easy as can be. Well, in 2022, Harvard's class is made up of 36% of legacy students. 36% of the class of 2022 is legacy admissions. Andrew, what percent do you think is black or African American?
I'm going to go with 11, and I'm crossing my fingers that it's as high as 11.
Not a bad guess, 8.9. So, three times? You know, three times the amount, the number of black people is just legacy admissions alone. That was the point I was trying to make. Sorry if I was a little clumsy in interjecting and it misled people as to what I was saying. But that's what I'm talking about. And it's an outrage. So if anybody ever talks to you about, you know, affirmative action and Ivy League and all that, you feel free to rattle off that statistic.
I would not have guessed that it was that. I mean, that is just a preposterous. That's four times higher, right? 9% African American.
That's a good point. Yeah,
36%. Yeah, that is a staggering number. I also think there was an interesting discussion to be had over standardized testing. So, listener John wrote in to talk. One of the folks who wrote in about Stuyvesant. This is an African American Stuyvesant grad, right? And so he wrote in to say, admission to Stuyvesant is based solely on a test. Eighth graders take this standardized test, and then students have their pick of which specialized high school they want to attend, starting at the top of the test score, right? So person who does the best on the test gets their pick of the schools. And assumedly picks Stuyvesant, which is a fantastic school. You know, Bronx High School of Science, can't go wrong with that either, right? Like a lot of really great public schools in Manhattan. Anyway, they start with the high score, they work down the list. As John points out, the racial disparity has become a divisive issue in New York City, and that there is an ongoing debate as to whether the sort of purely test-based system is more or less fair, right? And that is I 100% agree with John that, like, it's a really interesting question. I've actually read a lot of academic literature on this because it was one of Alex's debate topics. So my son has read a lot of academic literature on this, and I've read some. It's a really, really good question, right? Like, there is good evidence that there's systematic bias in standardized testing. There's also really good evidence for, you know, the Thomas point, which is right. But when you take away standardized testing, you're now left with huge amounts of discretion. And we've already seen what discretion gets you.
Yeah, I feel like that's the way it went. Like, people thought, oh, I see, people are being racist toward black people and not letting them into college. Let's go to something like an objective measure, like a test, and then that way it'll fix everything. And then I think what you see is that, oh no, there's actually huge... This is why things like critical race theory are so important, to show that it's a systemic issue and it's not going to be fixed by these little remedies that are targeted at, like, individual bias. Like, oh, let's just eliminate the individual bias in the admissions, you know, people or something. And that's not going to fix it because it's a big systemic problem.
That put a bow on that much better than anything I could say. So I'll just applaud and say, hear, hear.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. By the way, a late Lot Awful Movies that was just a confluence of things, but it's out now. Cop Rock 2. Go Woo! Check out Cop Rock Episode 2. And so, the following people who may be enjoying the Lot Awful Movies as we speak. Thanks to LT, Thomas Murphy. I've just signed up to the OA Patreon, and now I can easily skip hearing this name read out. There you go. Hey, if that's why you want to sign up, that's why you want to sign up. Allison R., Guardian Bellerin. Is that like Jace Bellerin in the Magic the Gathering reference? I don't know. Ghost Dog and Terrence Goggin. Your turn, Andrew.
Thank you to Emil, to Is a Sandwich. That is the most Dadaist version of that. To Matthew Russell, Jessica Robinson. No associate at this administration has ever been disbarred. And to, if UFOs are real, will the Space Force defend us from illegal aliens? Thank you all so much. That is, head on over patreon.com/law. Give us as little as a buck, and we will read out your name no matter how silly.
And you'll get ad-free episodes. Yeah. The shout-outs will be last, so you can skip them if you want to.
Yeah, you get Miss Ashley's stories in the news. You get 6 to 9 pages every week of additional stuff. We've looked. It is the best deal in podcasting, bar none.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE, Thomas Takes the Bar Exam. Hey, if you only started listening, you know, about 2 weeks ago, this is the segment in which I perfectly nail a bar question. And I get every single, we've done about, 200 something of these, where I just exactly nail the question.
As far as they know, you get them all right.
No need to go back and check.
No.
Let's see if I can keep this improbable streak going.
All right, Thomas, an entrepreneur from State A decided to sell hot sauce to the public, labeling it best hot sauce.
I already love this.
A company incorporated in State B and headquartered in State C sued the entrepreneur in federal court in State C. The complaint sought $50,000 in damages and alleged that the entrepreneur's use of the name best hot sauce infringed on the company's federal trademark. The entrepreneur filed an answer denying the allegations, and the parties began discovery. 6 months later, the entrepreneur moved to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Should the court grant the entrepreneur's motion?
Oh, God. Okay, I'm not getting this one.
A, no, because the company's claim arises under federal law.
Okay.
B, no, because the entrepreneur waived the right to challenge subject matter jurisdiction by not raising the issue initially by motion or in the answer.
Oh, my gosh.
C, yes, because although the claim arises under federal law, the amount in controversy is not satisfied. Or D, yes, because although there is diversity, the amount in controversy is not satisfied.
I will note, Andrew, while that we absolutely, as my failing test score historically has shown, we have all the integrity in the world in this game. I will note to the listeners, I do edit out a certain amount of me silently trying to figure out what in the world this question is even saying. So, peek behind the curtain. So there is so much going on. I think I understand some of it. So here's the thing. This is the typical, we've had a lot of questions and they've been difficult. And I think I've gotten some of them right, but most of them wrong when it comes to like this diversity jurisdiction, yada, yada, yada. Here's what we have. We've got State A, and I think this is all pointless. I think this is all attractive distractors because you got State A selling the hot sauce, State B headquartered in State C. They're trying to throw you off with, okay, the B, the C, and then if I remember right, it's $75,000 in damages and we have a $50,000 in damages thing. I think that's all to trick past Thomas, who would have gotten that wrong. I'm aided by the fact that the answers helped me out here, but I think that doesn't matter because it's a federal thingy. They've infringed on the company's federal trademark. I think all the, diversity and the $75,000, I think that would all matter if it was a state thing. Like if you were suing under State A's laws for State B and State C, blah, blah, blah. I think that because it's a federal thingy, you're just in federal court and all that other stuff doesn't matter, I think. And then it adds in another wrinkle, which is, well, they moved on with the thing. They filed an answer denying the allegations and they began discovery. But then 6 months later, the entrepreneur tries to move to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. And that's another attractive distractor because I think that would be true. I think if you didn't do that right away, I could imagine, I'm not sure about this, but I could imagine 6 months later you try to dismiss and they're like, well, hold on, we've already started the thingy. Like, you got to do that before we start all the thingies, is what I think. So let's see where this leaves us. So the entrepreneur who used best hot sauce and blah, 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 moves to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. So A, no, because the company's claim arises under federal law. That's what I actually think it is. I think it's just that. But let's see if I'm wrong. Maybe there's another answer that's better. B, no, because the entrepreneur waived the right to challenge subject matter jurisdiction by not raising the issue initially by motion or in the answer. Now, could this be a thingy where that's the closer answer? Like that answer happens first, you know? I don't think so. I think I'm still leaning toward A over B. C, yes, because although the claim arises under federal law, the amount in controversy is not satisfied. Now, that's a real attractive distractor, but I don't think that's how it works. I hope I'm right about this. I think if you're in federal thingy, you're in federal thingy. Because otherwise it would be like, you are allowed to screw someone over federally as long as the amount is $74,999. You can screw someone out of $74,999 and you're good. I think that's not right. I think the amount in controversy matters when you've got the diversity jurisdiction and you're trying to get into federal court, but it's a state law matter. I think that's right. So no, I'm going to go not C. Although C may be like the... No, I don't even think C is the second best answer. D, yes, because although there's diversity, the amount in controversy is not satisfied. Oh, that's like the same answer. I would say D is the... I almost think B is the second best answer. I'm almost fully on the no territory. Yeah, I just think C and D are both wrong. You know, I don't think it matters because we're in federal court. So those are both, I think those are both tricks. I think A is the right answer. I'm going to go, to help the coin out, I'm going to go between A and B. I actually think B, like maybe there's some weird thing where like, you know, that would be the quicker way that they would dismiss it. But so I'm going to go between A or B and let's see what the coin thinks. The coin agrees. So the coin and I both say A. Whew, we'll see. That's my final answer. The coin and I say A, final answer.
All right. And if you'd like to play along with Thomas and the coin, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed. And by the way, you will have to work hard to outdo last week's winner. That was hysterical.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Reminder, join us at that Patreon Q&A coming up. Check out the YouTube. That's an easy way to do it. Or look out for that Patreon notification you'll get. Either way, we can't wait to see you. And stay mad about this horrible Cosby thing, everybody. Yay. Have a nice weekend.
Happy 4th of July.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah. That's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.